The Guardian.
Number 10 Downing Street is rocked by a row over eugenics, and the new Chancellor confirms Budget Day. I'm Rowena Mason, Deputy Political Editor of The Guardian, and this is Politics Weekly.
Mr. Cummings, are you a fan of eugenics?
Do you regret his appointment?
Have you got any more weirdos?
Read Philip Tetlock's Super Forecasters.
Do you regret his
appointment? Instead of political pundits who don't know what we're talking about.
So do you regret his appointment?
Does number 10 condemn his views?
Another week, another clip of Dominic Cummings, Boris Johnson's de facto chief of staff. This time he's being questioned on whether or not Number 10 regrets hiring as an advisor a man who had suggested that intelligence is linked to race and that there could be legal enforcement of long-term contraception to combat unplanned pregnancies. Cummings didn't respond directly to the reporter's queries, but he is coming under increasing fire from within the Conservatives for having launched a weirdos and misfits hiring drive that brought this advisor, Andrew Sabisky, into Number 10 as a contractor. But how much control does Cummings really have? Is he just a happy scapegoat for the Prime Minister, or is this choice of appointment an example of future weirdos and misfits to come in this government? And in other news, earlier this week, my colleague Kate Proctor wrote about a report which revealed that so-called red wall voters might not have liked Labour's plans to tax the very wealthy even more. A survey found that ex-Labour supporters prefer the idea of taxes being fairer for everyone rather than just targeting the super rich. But will the new Chancellor factor this in when he presents the budget on March the 11th, as the Tories have been looking at the idea of a mansion tax too? And finally, we look at what's happening in the Labour deputy leadership contest, the rows over trans rights in the campaign, and the importance of having difficult women in Parliament. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, there was quite the furore at the weekend when comments made in the past by newly appointed advisor to Boris Johnson resurfaced. Criticism about Andrew Sabisky was quick to build from both opposition and Tory MPs alike, and in the end, the advisor decided to resign. But he wasn't exactly gracious about the whole thing, choosing to accuse the media of selective quoting rather than apologising for his offensive comments. Was Sabisky the kind of weirdo or misfit that Dominic Cummings envisaged when he published a blog post asking people to apply for jobs at Number 10? Will this incident affect Cummings' ability to hire and fire as he chooses, or will we simply hear less about those who do make it through the door? To discuss this and more, I'm joined in the studio by Faiza Shaheen, director of the Labour think tank Class, Will Tanner, the director of the centre-right think tank UK Onward, and Helen Lewis, reporter for The Atlantic and author of a new book, Difficult Women, A History of Feminism in 11 Fights. Now, Will, you formerly worked in Downing Street. Would you have been happy to have this Mr. Sabisky as a colleague?
My personal view is that this is a great shame, actually, because I'm very supportive of the desire to open up recruitment into Downing Street and wider government. Often the type of people who become advisors are from a relatively closed circle of people in think tanks and newspapers and the kind of broader policy world. And I think there are skill sets that can be brought to bear on government that currently aren't really brought in. But clearly this guy's comments brought the kind of reputation of the Prime Minister into question. They're not the type of comments that you would normally expect for people to be advising the Prime Minister. And so I think he was right to resign. But I hope that it doesn't preclude other people going into government who do have skills that aren't normally held by those in government.
And just to recap some of the things that Sabisky said, where he suggested that black Americans on average had a lower IQ than white Americans. And he suggested as well that there could be enforced contraception to prevent the creation of a permanent underclass, as he put it. Now, Faiza, Labour were quick to call for his sacking. Are you satisfied now that he's resigned, that all the questions that around this have been answered?
No, absolutely not. I'm absolutely outraged. It makes me feel sick that someone like that was invited into the heart of government. But then, should we be surprised? And it's a sign of the times that we are talking about eugenics, and I can't believe how backwards we're going.
Helen, in his resignation tweet, Sabisky was quick to attack the media for undergoing a giant character assassination. Do you think there's any truth in his claims that some on the right call offence archaeology is damaging in society?
Yes, I mean, this whole story smells enormously fishy to me, because first of all, what nurse was he actually hired to do, and what was his expertise for doing it? I've followed him on Twitter for a really long time as somebody who was, to me, a kind of one of those irritating men who think that they're incredibly intelligent and therefore would like to develop theories about intelligence that flatter them. The whole subject of race and IQ, actually, and sex and IQ, is just riven with pseudoscience. And people will often say, you know, of course, women score much less highly on IQ tests. And you kind of go, what is an IQ test measuring? And actually, how does that apply in the real world? And one of the great lessons, I think, of this whole saga is that people with undoubtedly very high IQs can do things that are nonetheless incredibly stupid. which is, I think, probably the big takeaway lesson that we should have from this. But that's what slightly worries me, is that, I don't want to get too conspiracist about it, but it almost feels slightly set up. I actually do feel sorry for Andrew Spisky, because, you know what, there are loads of people out there in Britain who've got various shades of appalling views, as far as I'm concerned. And what you don't do is put them in the full glare of a huge media campaign. He should have been vetted much more thoroughly. The whole idea that Dominic Cummings is essentially running a shadow recruitment operation from his blog and a Gmail account, it is unfair to expose people to this incredible, you know, white hot... I take Pfizer's point that I think what he said is appalling, but I think there are lots of people out there who have got similar things they said on Reddit when they were 22 that wouldn't stand up to scrutiny. And actually, there is a kind of duty of care about who you expose to that level of searing spotlight.
And the duty of care that you have to black people and the rest of the country that have to see that kind of view upheld in what should be the highest office in this country. And it's very hard to explain how much it undermines your humanity. You know, we're hearing it constantly. Obscure people with incredibly offensive and often racist views being given platforms and being given influence. And we have to be very, very careful about the road that we are currently on and the extent to which we are keeping a very close eye on who is coming through those doors. Because Dominic Cummings is meant to be this, you know, great genius or whatever. It was very easy to find things that this guy had said to Biscuit had said in the past. Did he not care? And in the future, will they just be more quiet about who they're hiring? But similarly, people with just these abhorrent views. And, you know, there's a lot of work that we need to do to keep an eye on what's happening there.
And there's some interesting points there, Will. Do you think it was a cock-up or conspiracy? Was Cummings being naive, or did he realise that this guy had some dubious views and simply not care, do you think?
Well, look, when I went into government 5 years ago, I was subjected to extraordinary levels of scrutiny. I mean, I was going into the Home Office, so there were security implications, but I mean, Number 10 is a place where lots of sensitive material is discussed.
And this
discussed.
Guy was reportedly working on defence matters as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're yet to see the full details, but I mean, I remember my finances were gone through, my family members were spoken to, basically everything I'd ever said publicly had was kind of vetted to the nth degree. So I think clearly there has been some failure of process here, and I think the government will probably not make this mistake again in terms of making sure that the people that they're hiring are above board and have not made comments that are going to kind of create this type of reaction.
Are we missing a big point here about the fact that Boris Johnson, when they did the press conference, his press advisor also wouldn't say that Boris Johnson agreed or disagreed with this view? And to me, it does seem like what was so difficult, what message, what kind of dog whistle politics is going on here with this kind of hiring and then a failure to sack him and a failure to say, I completely disagree with this.
Look, I mean, he entered government last week. He's not there this week. Like, it's not like he lasted very long. These comments came to light and he resigned. I think the most important thing is that the government gets its act together on the vetting and actually does continue to try and bring in people with different skill sets to government. Because the thing that could be lost here, which is important, is bringing genuinely kind of important scientific skills to government that currently are not there. And I've worked in government. There are a lot of people who do not have the type of kind of data science or scientific skills that you might expect at the heart of government. And I think that is an important thing that we shouldn't let
How
be
lost
from this episode.
How is that even part of this conversation? I'm sorry to say, someone at the heart of government has gone in and been hired by Dominic Cummings that has said that black people have lower IQ and all kinds of other outrageous things about, like, you know, working class people on contraception and the rest of it. And, you know, I don't care about what skills are going into government. I want us to have a conversation about why it is that we have a prime minister that won't distance himself from comments that are so abhorrent and so offensive. And I just don't understand why there isn't more outrage. it's morally repugnant. Like, how are we talking about skills? This is about a conversation about what is allowed to be said about race in this country right now and how that makes people feel.
Helen, what do you think about whether the Prime Minister should have been more robust about, or his spokesman should have been more robust about immediately saying Boris Johnson doesn't agree with these views?
I think Faiz hit the nail on the head, which is that the problem is that Boris Johnson is on record having said a lot of things that people find equally offensive, you know, and there is this whole genre of people who are generally tend to be quite well-off white men who like to dabble in these subjects that are seen as being kind of, oh, they're so hot to handle, but you know what, actually, let's have a conversation about eugenics. Isn't it great to kind of... And as Faiza says, to people who have been on the receiving end historically of the bad end of eugenics, those things are really hard to hear and not feel an immediate emotional response about.
This isn't some conversation far away from number 10. This is in number 10. And when you have that kind of prejudice at the heart of government, how will that influence policy over the next few years? How will that influence the way in which division has already been spread in this country? You know, we do a lot of work at Class on this distinction that's between the white working class and everyone else, even though the working class, of course, is multi-ethnic. The caricatures that have been built around that. And what does that say about the kind of politics that we have? So, you know, while some are saying that, you know, austerity is going to come to an end or they might invest more, but actually when it comes to immigration, when it comes to race issues, when it comes, they are going hard on that. And I think this week, and I don't think we should just say, oh, it was just a little mistake. I think the fact that the way that Boris Johnson's press spokesperson acted the way they did shows that they want to send a signal to this country that they are for white people. And that is really, really scary.
So Faiza's obviously incredibly outraged about this, and lots of people from all backgrounds will be. Will, do you think it will be damaging for the Conservatives? Do you think it's the kind of thing that will stick in the minds of black and minority ethnic voters when they come to look at the party?
I kind of agree with Helen that this is a 27-year-old who said some very stupid, clearly wrong things in the past, didn't expect to be put in the full glare of the media, and has now kind of resigned, I think, the right decision for him. For him and the government. I do think we need to kind of get back to the bigger picture, which is actually what this government is going to do for people of black and ethnic minority backgrounds, and ensure that the disparities that exist for those groups of people are closed and that those people have more opportunities over time. And that's, I think, where we need to be focusing our energy, rather than having a conversation about an advisor who was there for a week and by all accounts
didn't
really do very
much. But I think Faiza's got a really good point about the signal that this sends. And I think it's the same when I looked at the reshuffle and the fact that there were actually the number of women in the cabinet went down. And I think that you're right to say that this is a government that is not worried about diversity and message of inclusion to either women or ethnic minorities in the way that we have been used to, that putting it front and centre, right? And it does feel like it's a government that is some way sending signals to people like the old order is still there, don't worry, like the kind of people who've always been in charge are going to stay in charge and you can be reassured about that. It's a kind of an anti-modern message. It's about reassuring a certain type of voter that a certain type of person is still in charge of the world. I think that will resonate with black and minority ethnic voters. You know, we know that there are people who demographically from those, you would expect from those groups, who would be Tory voters, right, on every other measure, and yet they won't vote for the Tory party still because they think it's got that slight sniff about it that is, it's not for people like us. And I think these kind of things do resonate with people just on a very emotional level.
What do we think about what it says about Dominic Cummings's position in the government? Will, do you think, I mean, there are lots of rumours about how unhappy some Tory MPs are with him, going right up to cabinet minister level. Do you think there's a point in which he will just push it too far and Boris Johnson's interests will stop being aligned with Dominic Cummings and he might be shown the door?
I was in Downing Street when Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill were subjected to the same kind of criticism from Tory backbenchers, and there is a...
This seems to be intense...
No, I would say it's exactly the same as we had with Alistair Campbell, as we had with Fiona and Nick, and I think there is a culture of criticising the advisor because you don't want to criticise the Prime Minister. I mean, ultimately, I think Dominic Cummings is there to serve the Prime Minister. He will be there as long as the Prime Minister wants him to be, and he's acutely aware of that. I would argue that Dominic Cummings' position has been underestimated rather than overestimated in recent weeks in the budget. So the reshuffle, and I suspect the budget in a few weeks will demonstrate that. I think this is a prime minister who's just won a kind of pretty extraordinary majority, something that lots of people did not expect, including perhaps the former chancellor, and is actually relatively assured of his position and able to do some quite big radical things for the country. And that will be a shock for some people because we haven't had a large majority government in this country for some time. So that will, I think, slightly shock the system, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. And I think Dominic Cummings' position is quite assured.
Right, we'll have to leave it there for now and see who else Number 10 deems suitable for a job. After the break, Kate Proctor reports on the tax thoughts of the Red Wall voters, and we look at the deputy leadership race and why being a difficult woman in Westminster is necessary. We'll be right back.
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
Like, my father's 50 and praise God that he's still alive, but that's through kidney transplant, ripping a vein out of his leg to put in his arm. That's through having 8 units of blood every month, and that's touch and go if he actually gets that. This could stop that.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes, and fears when it comes to something called gene editing. It's a technology that could one day allow us to rewrite our DNA.
Actually, my son has severe learning difficulties, so he doesn't have capacity to make any decision for himself. I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me. Would I change him if I could? No.
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
It's important as well to give context, because we're all here and we're all people of African origin, and I think that very much shapes our response to things like this, because our history of being abused by science shapes us.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app, or head over to theguardian.com. where you'll find all the content from our Gene Gap project.
Welcome back to Politics Weekly. I'm Rowena Mason. Now, the new Chancellor, Rishi Sunak, announced yesterday that the next budget will be delivered on schedule on the 11th of March. But what can we expect to see in it? Will the Tories stick to their campaign promise of minimal tax reform? And do voters even want to see change? The Guardian's political correspondent was given access to an exclusive study where researchers spoke to voters about the concept of wealth and how people feel tax influences a person's ability to be wealthy. She has this report.
Tax is always a really big election issue. This time round, we had the Conservatives promising no tax rises, which was an interesting situation because they are also promising so much in terms of investment, public spending. So it was really hard to see how no tax rises would actually play out. And then you had Labour, who was focusing very much on taxing the wealthier in society. The very top percentage group would be taxed at a higher rate. Billionaires in particular, they would also raise taxes on things like corporation tax. So as any election, tax did play quite a significant part in the promises that were made to voters.
Have a seat, everybody.
So Tax Justice UK, which is a group that campaigns to try and reform tax, and Servation, which is a research group, went around the country doing 6 focus groups. 3 of them were in Red Wall seats. Those are the ex-Labour seats that went Tory at the general election. And then they did some Conservative constituencies, and they did some inner city London constituencies as well, which have a Labour MP. So they went to Wrexham, Blythe and Bury North. And those were the seats that really interested me, because those are the former Labour seats that went Conservative, and some of them went Conservative for the first time.
Along this evening. I just mentioned some of you. My name's Jane.
I went along to focus group in Bury North, and this is a really important place in the country because this is at the heart of the Conservative Red Wall victory. So this seat used to be Conservative, then it went Labour, and then it went Conservative again. And I got the impression you have a lot of voters there that over the years have essentially been swing voters. But what I was getting out of this focus group And obviously, we're just talking about one group of people at one fixed point in time. But what I was hearing was that this transfer of a vote to the Conservatives feels long term to them. They found it very hard to imagine that they'd be going back to Labour anytime soon.
I don't know Barry that well myself, but tell me about what the sort of the services are like in this area, what the public service is like, health, education, that kind of thing.
It's so interesting because in Bury, I think it's slightly wealthier than some of the other parts of the country that the focus groups went to. So wealthier than Wrexham, wealthier than Blyth in the northeast. And actually, people were surprisingly happy and content with the services that they had.
I think generally in Bury it's really good. A lot of the schools are good, and it's the best small town around here, and everyone comes here for shopping, and more people want to live here.
This was a real surprise because Boris Johnson has spoken so much about the Red Wall and the need to level up across the country and to try and make sure that there is more investment, essentially reversing austerity that's taken place under the Conservatives over the past decade. Except you had a group of voters here who were generally quite content. They didn't have any big infrastructure projects that they could list that they wanted in particular. There did seem to be an acknowledgement that health services needed more. But it was really hard to find people that were, you know, negative about it. And apparently that's a real contrast to the focus group that was held in Blyth. And people up there were really, really angry. And they wanted change, and they wanted to see change immediately. I mean, I think someone up there said they wanted to see concrete action in Blyth from the Conservative government taking place in just a matter of weeks.
So, I just want to quickly hand out these sheets with some thought bubbles on. You should have all got a pen and a piece of paper. And so if you just take one of those.
After that, they were given an exercise where they were asked to fill in thought bubbles with words that described what they thought a rich person was, what wealth meant to them. And it was interesting because I guess you have perhaps a stereotype of wealth being, you know, a really flashy car or a huge house. But actually, for most people, their vision of what wealth is was simply just being able to afford to live with perhaps one or two small luxuries.
I put less worry because you've got the privilege to be able to access different services without having to rely on the systems provided necessarily if you don't want to.
And that'll be interesting for the Conservative Party to listen to. Again, we're taking one focus group here, but people didn't have huge aspirations of what a wealthy lifestyle should be. It really was, they just want enough money to live comfortably.
Do you see society as being wealthy? Beth, you're shaking your head.
I don't, personally. There's a lot less wealthy people than there are.
Probably one of the most interesting moments from the focus group was when there was a discussion about the gap between poor people and rich people, and there was an acknowledgement that that is widening, and nobody wants to see anyone in poverty. But there was a really strong line of discussion which was about people perceived not to be paying their way.
Paying into the system, like paying our taxes and stuff, and then like to wander down the road but never have a job and have as just as what you've got, because I've got the same as what you've got, they're claiming that all the system.
So you feel like somebody that is contributing, paying their taxes,
yeah,
that's a wealthy person who's able to do that? Or
well, I think everyone should pay that anyway.
Yeah.
There was a lot of talk about the NHS being overburdened, people wasting time by going to the doctors relentlessly. There seemed to be a lot of concern about the misuse of the NHS.
Is it being misused? Is that the correct way of doing it? Would then putting £10 on going to see a GP stop those people who are just going to get a sick note because can't remember where to work?
You know, yeah. From one person in particular, they seem to be really, really angry about this notion that they're a taxpayer, they're paying into the system, and people are still not taking part in it in a fair way. People are being given handouts. And actually, when you talk to some of the people who'd recently changed their vote from Labour to Conservative, this culture of handouts, people not having to work for a living, people living off benefits, that was actually still quite a strong area of concern for some people.
I just think they probably worked their ass at university or whatever they've done to get to that point, so good luck to them, yeah.
I'd say that it's nothing to do with us. I think if you're bitter about someone, then that, you know, you don't need to look at your own life, really.
So Labour talked a lot about taxing billionaires in the election as if that was going to be a really positive way of attracting lots of votes. But actually, from the people in these very specific groups, they were unhappy with that idea. Lots of people thought billionaires had deserved their money. They had got it through hard work. Therefore, why should they be taxed at a higher rate to anyone else? There was maybe one or two people who wanted to see billionaires, you know, being paying a lot more into the system. But generally, any attack on anyone wealthy, whether that's a neighbour over the road who just happens to have a nice house compared to, let's say, a footballer, they actually didn't want to see any punitive taxes on people that are higher earners. They would just prefer a tax system that to them feels fair. So now we know the budget is fixed for March the 11th. Whether the Conservatives are about to unleash a huge amount of public spending and when they talk about levelling up, whether that includes tax changes, you know, we're not entirely sure. I do think the Conservatives have quite a narrow pool of policy areas where they can dip in and out of in terms of changing tax. So we'll just have to wait and see how far they're prepared to go.
The Guardian's Kate Proctor there. OK, we're going to move on to Labour now. We've focused a good bit on who's running for the Labour leadership in the past episodes, but there are a further five candidates campaigning to be deputy leader of the party. Dr. Rosanna Allen-Khan, Richard Bergen, Dawn Butler, Ian Murray and Angela Rayner are all aiming to be second in command. Now, Faiza, you're a former Labour parliamentary candidate. We should start with you here. Who have you been the most impressed with?
In terms of what the job entails and then looking at qualifications, then I've been really impressed with Dawn Butler. I mean, Dawn Butler also lost a seat and gained it again. So she knows what it's like to have to fight a marginal seat. It's very, very different, I can assure you, to be given a safe seat. So I think in terms of being the campaigner in chief, she certainly does have that. But I mean, they all appeal to different parts of the party in a way. You know, Richard, it's got very strong left politics, you know, Angela Rayner, of course, has this very inspirational story, very good in the media. So I think, you know, actually that there is a really good choice there for people across the party. Personally, when I look across, it did really upset me that whilst when you look at the list of qualities needed, Dawn ticked them again and again, she came at the bottom of the ballot when it was just the PLP. And I think that I thought was strange, given how strong she is, and given that she, you know, didn't stab Corbyn in the back and she has served under different prime ministers. And so she can play that calming role as well. But yeah, I mean, I think they've all got quite a good case to make.
And I spoke to Dawn Butler last week for an interview, and she pointed out that she was the first black woman to stand at the dispatch box in the UK Parliament. And she also pointed out that out of all the nominating constituency Labour parties, she'd been in combination with all of the different leadership candidates. Helen, I wondered, is there a duo that you can think of from both the campaigns that naturally lends itself to a winning combination?
I professionally have no opinion on who is the best person to lead the Labour Party. My opinions on the Labour Party are probably not welcome at this point, but I think what's interesting about the dynamic is that I think a lot of people have seen that Angela Rayner is so far ahead in the deputy leadership race, and that has made them feel okay about voting Keir Starmer for leader, right? Because there was a lot of pressure about it's got to be a woman this time. It's actually just getting quite embarrassing now, and people have kind of said to themselves, okay, well, I'm going to vote for a guy for leader, but it's fine because we'll have a female deputy leader. I disagree with Faiza on Dawn Butler. I think I've always liked her, and I think she's been very impressive during her time in Parliament. I think recently she's wandered into, bizarrely, a lot of minefields that are exactly on her brief, her qualities brief, and ended up just making a bit of a hash of them. She gave a strange speech in which she started talking about giraffes being gay. And it's one of those things where you're like, what are you trying to end up in the Daily Mail? What are you doing? And then she had a very odd interview with Richard Madeley this week where she started trying to claim that babies were born without a sex. And it's one of those things where I get that the idea, like the whole conversation around gender identity is incredibly fraught. But like if your subject is equalities, it is your duty to make and frame Labour arguments in a way that is suitable for the audience that you're making them to, for a mainstream audience. So I think that has dented her a bit. You know, Ian Murray makes a great claim about the fact, well, he's Labour's sole redoubt in Scotland, but is very much seen as being on the right of the party, which is obviously not in fashion now. And, you know, I think Rosine Allen Khan has been quietly quite impressive, but does not have the name recognition to kind of get anywhere. Richard Bergen's comments for me on anti-Semitism are, you know, and Zionism are disqualifying. But it's certainly an interesting broad field that represents the full breadth of the party. And I think, as Pfizer says, exactly what appeals to a lot of people about Angela Rayner is that inspirational story, which melds together the two wings of the party. You know, she served under Corbyn, but she can go back and say, sure start under the Blair years, this was really helpful to me. And there is a bit of an appetite for a bit of healing, although not among everybody. I went to a Rebecca Long Bailey campaign event the other week, and the biggest cheers were about MPs who stabbed Corbyn in the back and the media is always against us. So there is still a big caucus in Labour that feels very bruised and wounded and isn't ready to talk about a big open offer that's reaching out to all wings of the party.
And Will, from a Conservative perspective, is there any of those deputy leadership candidates that you think the Tories wouldn't want to see up on the media attacking them every day?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm not as well qualified as perhaps Helen and Faisal to respond to the question about deputy leadership. But I do think Angela Rayner has proven herself time and time again. And I think she is the type of person that the Conservative Party might have actually feared slightly more than some of the leadership candidates, and perhaps relieved that she went for the deputy leadership, which I think was a clever tactical move for her personally. I think this is a leadership race to be sat out of rather than to participate in for the Labour Party. But it really does kind of personify the big choice that the Labour Party faces. Does it continue along the direction of travel that's been going for some years towards quite significant kind of social liberalism and left liberalism on social issues? Or does it try and move back into the centre ground? And I think of those candidates, Angela Rayner has the potential to satisfy both the kind of left wing of the Labour Party while moving them into a direction that's much more in common with ordinary voters in this country, especially as voters that the Labour Party lost at the last election.
And Faisal, Helen touched there on this row over trans rights in the contest so far that's been causing some controversy for both the deputy and the leadership candidates, particularly over some of them having signed a charter, which is, I think it's called a Women's Place, and is a trans exclusionist hate group. Leadership candidate Emily Thornberry, or former leadership candidate Emily Thornberry, I should say, warned against using the term hate group in relation to this issues. Do you feel like there's a particular divide about this among women party members? It seems to be getting quite heated as a debate, doesn't it?
It has become very heated. It's been really interesting the last few years to see how these conversations and just in general transphobia in society has really sparked off. And I think there are conversations to be had, partly because we have more people, quite rightfully, because they feel like they should be a woman or they should be a man, you know, identifying and then going through particular changes. But it feels to me that we should absolutely make the point about the Labour Party being there to fight discrimination and stand up for equality groups. But we've kind of gone down this cul-de-sac and we found ourselves in like a lot of trouble and without the language to really be able to talk about it. And so it's really kind of blown up in this leadership election. And what's happened is that it really plays into as well the way in which Dominic Cummings and the Riot want us to be having these sort of cultural
battles, arguments. Yeah.
And that's a little bit frustrating. It is an important issue, of course it is. And, you know, it's something in society more generally we need to face and discuss. But it's dominated the discussions and I've been a bit surprised by that.
Helen, how do you think Labour resolves this difficult issue? Because there's obviously some very upset Labour women members and on the other side, lots of people who say that the party really needs to stand up for trans rights and fight discrimination.
What's gone wrong in this debate is that a couple of organised lobby groups have essentially said that there is no debate to be had, right? The Labour Campaign for Trans Rights Pledge, which all the women in the leadership and deputy leadership races have signed, says there is no balance to be had between women's rights and trans women's rights, that these things never come in contact, and to say there is completely is transphobic. And the problem is that is just not a line that holds, right? So I have always said and been very clear that I think trans women, trans men and men, but they have experiences that are different because of different biology. And in the same way that trans women experience unique type of oppression that is due to the fact, you know, that they have been through gender reassignment, so do women born biologically female. And to say, declare with a snap of your fingers that there are no hard conversations to be had, had. That's not how politics works. And it's very notable to me that Keir Starmer didn't sign that. He signed a different one from a much more established Labour group, Labour LGBT, which didn't have the rhetoric in it about trans-exclusionary hate groups, right? It was much less inflammatory. And my big concern about this debate, as ever, is that always it falls on women harder.
I mean, I just think, like, just like what happened with homophobia and gay rights and, you know, what happens through time when these different issues come up, transphobia and has come up massively in the last few years, again, because people are making the switch more now. So it's forcing a conversation. And obviously, because the Labour Party does have that history, that's why it's become big. But I also think that we've partly stuck ourselves in it. And I think I'm not an expert on these things, but I do think we need to find a way to have some parts of the conversation, but also not undermine that a group that is being really heavily affected in society right now and targeted and made to feel not welcome within our movement. And so I think we have to, there's a lot of work to be done there.
The government is about to come out with its proposals for how to reform the Gender Recognition Act. Will, does that mean this argument's coming to the Conservatives soon?
Well, I think this argument's been going on within the Conservatives for the last few years. And I think there are some really serious questions about the ways in which we recognise trans rights and we ensure that that transphobia isn't rising and that we properly respond to that. I think the Conservative Party, for what it's worth, will have some quite difficult conversations about this. There are lots of different groups within the Conservative Party, just as there are in Labour, including religious groups and others, which might come to this from different perspectives. And so this is a topic that is coming. But I would just urge everyone to kind of have the debate in the right fashion, rather than focusing on one aspect of it, because I think it's the type of thing that could get quite ugly quite quickly unless we do it properly.
And Helen, we just wanted to talk finally about your book. You've written a...
Yes, always I want to talk about my book.
You've written a book called Difficult Women. I wondered what you make of women in Parliament, how difficult they are, especially in the Labour leadership contest.
I think the Labour leadership contest has amused me and in a kind of sad way, because it was so much... The idea was that there was going to be a woman this time, have to be a woman this time. And I think John McDonnell for years championed Rebecca Long Bailey because he felt that, you know, the pressure would be on that it would need to be a woman next time. The left should have a really strong female candidate to put up against, you know, the rest of the party, because I think the party just still felt quite factionalised around that. So I think there is a kind of slight feeling on the left that there's a sort of feeling of, well, hang on a minute. We thought the rules were that the next time it had to be a woman, and why has everyone else decided actually they're actually totally fine with being a man, which is a kind of classic story of Labour politics, right? The all-women shortlist, I think you make a good argument that part of the rationale behind them was about squeezing out the left of the party. Diane Abbott criticised them, I think, at the time for saying they often ended up being all-white women shortlists, right? They didn't take other types of diversity into account. But yeah, I think it is always harder to be a woman in politics than it is a man, because you just look slightly different. Starting at the very, very basic level of not being able to wear a navy suit and a white shirt and that being a completely neutral uniform that no one ever comments on, right? You have to make a choice whether you're going to be Angela Merkel in your pantsuit or whether you're going to be Tracy Brabin in an off-the-shoulder dress. There is no way to dress yourself that means that people don't comment on it. You have to, if you're a man, you have to really go full Dominic Cummings and just turn up in like a sort of Smurf outfit and a beanie and trousers around your ankles in order to get anybody to talk about what you're wearing.
Fizer, are you disappointed that it looks like it's going to be a male leader of the Labour Party once again, leaving aside Keir Starmer's personal qualities, just the symbolism of it?
Yeah, of course, I would like to see a woman. But politics, of course, matters. And I think one of the things that's happened, given the results, is that people have got so scared that I'm seeing people that I wouldn't have expected to feel like this essentially go for what looks like power. And that's disappointing from a lefty point of view, you know. And I think that's a bit of what's happening.
I think you're right about as well to say about Dawn Butler. I think one of the things that's really interesting when you look at the polling, all right, they did this polling about in the US about, you know, would you vote for a female candidate? And people said, yeah, of course I would. Do you think other people would vote for a female candidate? And they went, oh, no, I think other people are really sexist. So there gets to be this kind of dynamic of, well, what's electable? We really want to beat Donald Trump. So what's electable? Let's pick the one who feels safest to us. And I think if you're a woman, particularly if you're a black woman, you don't feel safe, right? You feel like, oh, well, hang on a minute, are other people going to have a problem? Is this going to lose us seats in X constituency that we've decided is incredibly racist? And actually, that's a bar that you don't even get to get the chance to make your case.
I mean, one thing we do need to do, though, loads more, is to support women, especially women of colour. Like Dawn, part of why I support her, not that I know her massively, but when I was getting racism locally, and including from the Lib Dem candidate, she called me. And it just actually having that support, talking about her experiences, you know, that a bit of moral support, knowing there was someone I could call if I was really angry about it or, you know, struggling with it, that really helped. So, you know, I think that those sorts of, which seem like small things, can go a long way. But also just coming to defence, you know, I saw Diane Abbott was trending on Twitter this morning. And I just knew there would be loads of hate, and I just made the mistake of clicking on the trend. And, you know, we need people there just willing to stick up for people online. And we also need to be ready with the libel lawyers when it gets to that point as well, when, you know, when women are being targeted in a particular way in the press. And so, yeah, I think there's a number of things you can do, and people just need to feel supported, that even though you might get some hate, that's completely outweighed by the love and support you get, which I think was true in my case. And I'm really grateful for people and Dawn Butler for calling me. She was the only one.
Yeah, I think that's really important. Actually, it's when women get to a kind of critical mass that becomes a lot easier to do. You know, the women's PLP is now a fairly fearsome kind of beast. And that some things like that have happened a little bit in the Conservative Party. The weird dynamic is, in a way, I think the Conservative Party finds it easier to elect women leaders because it frames them as exceptions. Mm-hmm. And it's not like if you, like, this is it, you've opened the floodgates to every woman ever. Do you know what
on what basis do you say that?
Well, I think that the idea is that you frame it as kind of Elizabeth I syndrome, right? Like, I you know, I might be a woman, but I'm as good as a man, rather than making the case that actually all women are equally capable.
I worked for Theresa May, who was like the original bloody difficult. Yeah. Woman, right? And Theresa, throughout her entire parliamentary career, framed her femininity as an advantage over her other cabinet ministers or shadow cabinet ministers. It was the reason why she became chairman relatively early in her career. It was the reason why, as Home Secretary, she gained a lot of respect from people, because she took advantage, I think, in some respects, of her femininity. And people, I think, didn't see her as a man in any respect. They didn't look for masculine qualities in Theresa. In many respects, she positioned herself as the opposite, the kind of old boys club of conservative politics, and something different. And I think lots of people genuinely wanted to vote for a female leader in 2016 after David Cameron stepped down. The comparison to the Labour Party, I think, is really interesting, because the Labour Party, as you say, I mean, this was meant to be the time. It looks increasingly like it might not be.
But I think the dynamic is interesting, that you get the Tory party's got two female leaders, but like only 25% female MPs. Labour Party, majority female PLP, but can't ever get them right to the top.
I think it's that, not just that it's a woman. So if it's a woman that is going to protect the status quo and be on the right, then you can kind of take that in the mold. But if it's a woman, you know, that's going to bring real change, and, you know, who's basically, you know, pushing for real policy, dramatic policy change, I think that's too much together. I think that's the thing. You know, she's a woman, and we're not quite sure about the policy she's saying. She's too radical or whatever. People get spooked, not because it's a woman plus all of those other things. And I think, I mean, I don't think that's good enough. And I think we need to, like, fight for power to look different and to be for women to be able to be in those positions. But I think that's partly what happens with why it's all right for the Conservatives, because it's a conservative woman.
It was very noticeable to me that Boris Johnson ran a very different style of campaign from Theresa May. It was, I think Theo Bertram, the former Labour advisor, described it as like a nine-year-old boy's idea of what, like, men do, like driving a digger truck through stuff and kind of putting on a hard hat. And it feels like they do feel very blokey, this government, in a way that I don't think Theresa May's government did. The tone of it, you know what I mean?
Yes, I mean, lots of Conservative leaders act and sound very different from their immediate...
He has fallen back, though, on women in his cabinet, hasn't he? Just by one, but it's not a step forward.
No, and I mean, the government's briefed very heavily that they are trying to promote women to junior ranks of cabinet in order to fix that in the future. But there are lots and lots of people around the Conservative Party who recognise that the party needs to do better at promoting women. And there are a huge number of very, very, very good female MPs at junior ranks and indeed in the new intake.
On that note, we'll leave it there. When you're done listening to the podcast, you should head over to read Helen Lewis's weekend piece for The Guardian, the extract from her book Difficult Women, which can be found on The Guardian website. A huge thanks to Helen, as well as Pfizer, Will and Kate Proctor for joining me on the show this week. The producers were Madeline Finlay and Daniel Stevens. I'm Romina Mason. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.